from the studios of Central Coast Public Radio KUSP in Santa Cruz, California. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Novelist, historian, musicologist Anthony Rudell is my guest this week. His new book is The Wonderful Little History of Radio, entitled Hello Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. Anthony Rudell, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Nice to be with you. Thanks very much for having me.
You know, I read someplace that indoor toilets took a while to catch on because consumers were afraid of sewer gases poisoning their home. And I remember well the resistance to microwave ovens when they first came out. People were afraid of radiation. My mom bought one, and I asked her, you know, are you worried about it? She goes, well, we've had it for a few days, and nothing's happened, so I guess we're okay. But was there resistance to radio? Were people nervous about invisible radio waves coming into their home?
Well, there were stories that there are famous stories, I mean, especially in rural communities. The concept of these radio waves was alien, to say the least. One farmer, there's a great story about a farmer, I don't remember what state it was in, who was out in his property, and a bird fell out of the sky and died, you know, just dropped to the ground, and the farmer assumed he'd been hit by a radio wave. So there was some, apprehension about the technology. But the truth is that it caught on very quickly once there was something to listen to. You do have to wonder, I mean, I'm often asked, you know, what caused you to write the book? And what really triggered it for me was the concept of about 1920 or 1921 of a farmer in rural Kansas, let's say, goes to the state fair or to the big town, his one trip a year. And he comes home and his wife says, what's that? And he says, oh, it's a new thing I bought in town. And it's a box, and it's got some dials and some wires, and there's a battery, and you turn it on. It's called a radio, and it cost me $75. And she says, well, what do you do with it? And he says, well, we put it on at night, and we can sit in the living room and sit together, and we can listen to people talking in New York or Chicago or Nashville. We can listen to music from Los Angeles. And she looks at him and says, John, you've been drinking again. And the concept had to be totally... This thought of sound traveling hundreds of miles into your home.
Without any, you know,
with nothing.
Nobody inside it or whatever.
Right.
Well, now, you know, what's always puzzled me at the beginning of radio or at the beginning of television, when there were first, you know, the first broadcasts before there were people, enough people to hear them or anybody, you know, so when were the first radio broadcasts that were intended for someone to hear them?
Well, you put your finger on what I call in the book is the greatest business chicken and egg story of all time.
Right.
Why would you build radios, or why would you buy a radio if there was nothing to listen to? And why would you create radio programming if no one had a radio? So what ultimately happened is the companies that were building the radios also started creating the programming, and therefore created their own market. The first real moment you can look at, I mean, there's a debate whether it was a radio station in Detroit. The one I like to look for, though, is the one in Pittsburgh, KDKA, which on the night of November 2nd, 1920, decided it would be an interesting thing to do the presidential election returns. And so they set up a makeshift studio on the roof of the Westinghouse building in East Pittsburgh, and... Frank Conrad was the engineer. He was so nervous that it wouldn't work that he went home to his house where he had a crystal transmitter set up and was ready to do his news from there. And actually the one in Pittsburgh worked beautifully, and they got results from the Pittsburgh Post, which sent them via telephone line, you know, numbers, and an announcer leaned into a microphone and read out election results. And that was November 2nd, 1920. And they estimate that, you know, amateurs listening nearby, some several hundred miles away, by the way, because the way sound bounced, that somewhere between 500 and 1,000 people heard that broadcast. And to give you an idea of how quickly the medium caught on, 12 years later, November, I think it was November 4th or November 5th, 1932, when Franklin Roosevelt beat Hoover to win the presidency, the election returns were carried coast to coast on network radio and were heard by somewhere around 60 million people. So that gives you a sense of the growth. pretty amazing.
And I guess politics and entertainment grew side by side, and religion. We'll get to all that in a second. But
absolutely.
In some ways, I guess the advent of radio is the end of unamplified oratory. I mean, people would sit around and listen to Lincoln or William Jennings Bryan, and those people could speak to thousands of people without a microphone.
I mean, you wonder how many of them actually heard it, or how many people said, "What did he say?"
Yeah, I wonder.
Whereas, you know, once suddenly you started, and then the megaphone came along, which changed that a little bit. But now you have the opportunity to reach thousands of people just by sitting in your studio, as you do, and reaching out to people all over the listening area, as we used to call it. It did change that. It certainly changed political oratory. I mean, there's no question about that. Suddenly, politicians had to rejigger their stump speeches, because you couldn't deliver the same stump speech every few hours on the radio.
People
so
already
had
heard it.
Different speeches, right? Everybody had heard it already. Well, you better say something new, or you know, you're a pretty boring individual. So it changed politics for sure. Oh, absolutely. I mean, as I said, the first election was 20, and then, you know, Harding gave a couple of speeches on the air, and Coolidge gave a couple of speeches on the air, and Coolidge gradually gave more speeches. But the first big moment in politics was the 24 conventions, plural, both the Democratic and the Republican. And the Republican was a really quick thing where they nominated Coolidge, who had replaced Harding as president. Harding died in 23. And Coolidge had become president. Will Rogers had a great line about that. He said, "For all the excitement, the Republicans could have done this convention by postcard." Then a few weeks later, the Democrats met in New York, and they had something like 104 ballots, and it was a disaster for them because it sounded ridiculous to people listening at home. And that helped swing the election to Coolidge against a man named John Davis, who had never run for political office before, which says something about that nominating convention. Then in 28, the Democrats had learned their lesson, and they ran Al Smith, and there was no fight, and FDR gave a resoundingly brilliant nominating speech for Smith. And the Republicans had a little battle, because some wanted Hoover, some wanted other people, and so there was a skirmish, and there was some shouting on the air, and there was people banging pots, and there were six long nominating speeches that went on and on and on and on. And in the end, Hoover, who had been Secretary of Commerce under Harding and then Coolidge, Hoover was actually the genius in the Commerce Department who organized the radio system, and it's still the radio system we use today, by the way, the transmission systems of frequency and power and all that. And so he runs for president in 28 against Al Smith, and for anyone out there who thinks there's something new under the sun in politics, just so you're comfortable with the concept, the Democrats accused Hoover of trying to run a campaign in which he was hiding from the fact that he'd been part of the administration for the last 8 years. And the Republicans ran a campaign in which they accused Al Smith of being a socialist, and that he was going to raise taxes and increase the size of government. So there's absolutely nothing new under the sun.
In fact, even when we talked, you know, this summer, people were talking about the, you know, sort of boring, pre-planned nature of the conventions. You know, the beginning, the seeds of that were sown, I guess, in 1924.
Oh, yeah. No, it all started back there on radio. Suddenly you realized that these had to be shows that could be played at home kind of thing, you know, and it was a different experience for listeners. And what you see today, in the sense of these completely staged galas. In fact, I wrote a piece for U.S. News about it. You know, it's completely staged and organized, and that all began in 24 with the errors of the Democrats and then the errors of the Republicans in 28. So by the time 32 rolls around, they both have figured this out pretty well. The Democrats possibly better. I mean, and FDR was the first president to actually make his acceptance speech at the convention, and he did it in 32 because of the radio.
Was FDR's command of the radio akin to what we think of Kennedy's command of television?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's actually a wonderful parallel. I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but I think that's a wonderful parallel. He owned the medium. His speeches were so brilliant, his ability to resonate. There was a letter I read, and I think I quoted it in the book, of Lillian Gish, the great actress, having heard FDR give one of his first radio speeches as president, she said of him, "Your voice was like phosphorescence on the air," which is just a beautiful line. And it was. I mean, this man knew how to phrase everything, how to sound calming, how to sound completely in control of the situation and convincing. And he understood the medium probably better than anyone did at that juncture.
We're talking with Anthony Rudell, and his book is called Hello, Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. Well, religion and radio seem to go together in the early days also. Tell us a little bit about that.
Religion, you know, it's an interesting thing. Ben Franklin wrote a great thing about the reason we need separation of church and state. And I suppose if he'd lived to the 20th century, he would have written a piece about why you need separation of broadcasting and religion. Because the power of the pulpit, when superimposed with the power of the airwaves, that magic, what Hoover actually in his memoirs referred to as the magic of that, the propaganda, that everything on the air sounds like propaganda because of the magic of the technology. You combine those two powers, those two magics, and suddenly you have an incredibly powerful vehicle. And people who found that out early on, I mean, there was a church in Pittsburgh that in January of 1921, KDKA, again, very, you know, advanced-looking station, stuck a microphone into a church and said, okay, this becomes part of our programming, so people who can't get there can hear the service. And then, there are a lot of interesting characters on the radio back then in the religious area, but there are two who are great. Amy Semple McPherson, the great evangelist who had driven coast to coast with her mother, giving speeches and revival meetings in what she called her canvas cathedral. She had a tent that they would set up, and people would come, and she would save lost souls, and you know, people would give money, and that's how she made her living. But she gets to Los Angeles, and she starts to preach, and she gives a very optimistic view of life and of the afterlife and of God and redemption and all that. And Harry Chandler, who was the publisher of the Los Angeles Times, owns radio station KHJ, and he puts her on the air. And she's an instant hit on the air. So she says, well, I'm going to build my own radio station. So she goes and builds her own radio station and her own temple, which seats 5,000 people. And she becomes the most powerful broadcaster on the West Coast. And then there's a great story about her disappearing, and it turns out, I won't ruin the story of her, but she's found suddenly, you know, they think she's drowned in the Pacific, and then it turns out she claims to have been kidnapped, and when the whole story washes out, the truth is she was away having a tryst with a married man who happened to be one of her employees, and he happened to be the radio engineer who built her station. So in all the newspaper clippings, it's great. It's McPherson in tryst with Radio Man, as if the Radio Man were some, you know, foreign entity. So that was Amy Semple McPherson. And then also in Los Angeles, there was Fightin' Bob Schuller, who was another radio evangelist, well, not a radio preacher, actually. And then the most lethal in many ways, or the most dangerous, was Father Charles Coughlin, mm-hmm. who, you know, started in Detroit in 1926, and becomes a national figure. I mean, 3 o'clock on Sundays was known as Father Coughlin time. And this man made millions upon millions of dollars. And at first turned against Hoover and then endorsed FDR. And then as soon as FDR became president, turned against FDR and teamed with Lindbergh actually later in the 30s and into the early 40s to try to convince the United States to stay out of World War II. So they're the three main religious figures. But, yeah, religion on the air was a big business, to put it bluntly. And, you know, it still is today. How many, you know, how much religion is on TV? How many churches of the air are there? So a lot of what you see back in the 20s, where the book is set, is repeated today.
The origins of all of our, almost all of our forms of popular culture can be found in radio.
Actually, all I've yet to find one that wasn't.
No. Well, how did the networks take hold?
Well, networks are an interesting situation. I mean, there were forms of networks before that. I mean, as early as 1924, you start seeing wired groups of stations working together. You know, for example, when Coolidge makes his acceptance speech in 1924, or Al Smith in 28, there were stories in the papers about how many radio stations from coast to coast would be carrying that broadcast, that speech. And it was basically what we would call an unwired network. It was a network of stations. It was just the numbers of stations that agreed to carry it, and one station would feed the next. But then in 1926, David Sarnoff, who was head of RCA, had this great idea of creating NBC, the National Broadcasting Corporation, and taking all of the RCA stations who, which then became their, the ones they owned, and those that then became affiliated with them. And the theory was if they had that kind of power as a group, they could create better programming. There would be more money for programming, and you could take groups in New York or Chicago or L.A., and you could have tremendous power, and that's where all the great network shows came out of. You mentioned Rudy Valley before. That was an NBC show. So, you know, that was the way it grew. And then CBS came along a year later, started by Paley. Mm-hmm. And that's how it began.
Now, is it true that I've heard that the networks held television back because they had invested so much money in radio?
I don't know if it's true, but it certainly would be logical. I mean, the technology for television was there. I mean, people knew how to do it. But you got to remember, people were still getting used to radio.
Mm-hmm.
It was only, you know, when the networks came along in 26, it had only been around for 5 or 6 years. So they had to give it some time. Whether they held it back for that reason or not, I don't know for sure.
Well, we're speaking with Anthony Rudell, and his book is called Hello, Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. Your book ends kind of where most people consider radio's golden age to begin. So what was on the radio in the 1920s?
Well, it's kind of interesting. The first question you have to ask is, when was the radio on? One of the things that I had, you know, we live in this wonderful world of 24/7 media. If you're an insomniac and you get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you can turn the radio on, then there's something there. You turn the television on and there's something there, and of course the internet is always there. But back then, in the early 20s, especially as radio stations were being licensed and built all around the country, they kind of signed on and off whenever it was convenient. I saw one article, I think it was in 1923, in a station in California, actually, I couldn't tell you where, that had announced to the newspaper that Thursday at 3:30 they were going back on the air, they were going to turn the transmitter back on, because a guy was in town who could whistle the first act of Carmen. And that was going to be the broadcast. And as soon as that was done, they'd shut off. So radio stations were not on all the time in the early days. They'd be on for a couple hours maybe, then they'd shut down, and then they'd turn it back on later on in the day. And then there'd be maybe an evening show with some discussion or some music. But there was no consistency to programming. That came later on. But what was on originally was anything you could find, literally. I mean, if a singer was visiting Chicago to sing at the Chicago Civic Opera, as it was called back then, a radio station in Chicago might take that person and say, gee, we have a piano, we have a microphone, come sing a song. And that would be a broadcast. You know, people would do little bits of news. They would read a story or two. There was the children's book hour on some stations. So there was, you know, whatever you could think of that could be a show or fill up 15 minutes of airtime. There was one, I read one report where in Philadelphia there were two radio stations that were both going to be on at a particular time because the head of a union was giving a speech to his members. And that was a show.
Hmm.
People didn't know what to put on the air. I mean, what do you use this for? Do you use it to entertain? I mean, there was a sort of a prohibition against playing records on the air. I mean, why would you use this great technology to do what anyone could do at home? Go out and buy the records yourself. So it was anything and everything. Sports, for example. Sports was the logical place to start. I mean, you had boxing in 1921. You had the famous Dempsey-Carpentier fight. Wherever there was a legend, like a Dempsey, or in baseball, Babe Ruth beginning in 22, 23, in 24, you start looking at baseball World Series. Not every game, just the World Series. And in fact, the first year they only broadcast the first two games, and that's okay, enough of that. After that, it became a little more of an official thing. And college football was very big, but not the college football we think of today. I mean, the broadcasts in the first years were not the Alabamas and USCs of the world, but there was a very big broadcast one day of in 23, I believe it was, or 22, of Princeton against the University of Chicago. Hardly what we would call a mainstream college football battle today. But back then, that was big. So those were the three drivers of sports on the radio, was boxing, the World Series, and college football.
So how much of the growth of sports in America is due to the existence of radio?
Well, I think the interest in it, the mass appeal of it certainly begins in the 20s with broadcasting. I mean, look, they tried everything. I read one article in which they announced that they were going to have a ping pong tournament on the radio. And I'm a pretty creative radio guy for the life of me.
How do you call
that? I can't think of what that would sound like. You know, clunk, 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 clunk. Oh, he wins. You know, it would be a very short broadcast. But they tried everything. The horse racing later on gets, you know, it becomes important. They did. There was a station in Michigan that during the summer did a regatta on the Great Lakes. I can't imagine what that sounded like. I mean, how do you tell? So, oh, the boat pulled ahead. Well, there's an exciting broadcast. But that's what they did. They tried everything.
The Rudy Valley Hour. Tonight's headliners: Frank Craven, Ethel Merman, Eric Bloor. Everybody, this is Rudy Valley and Company. Attributed to Mr. Eric Bloor, our visiting Englishman, is the following remark. Quote, "You know, I've always liked the Valley program. It's so beastly American. We accept Mr. Bloor's opinion as a compliment. We hope we are decidedly American, meaning vigorous, hearty, and paced for speed and punch. Tonight's show, we feel, is particularly star-spangled, sort of George M. Cohan himself. I can't imagine a more typically Yankee Doodle actor than Frank Craven, who plays a philosophical plumber in Who's This at the Dyke, a comedy of repairs. Frank will be assisted by a remarkable boy actor, Master Ronald Liss. The intensely American art of the popular song is represented by the top practitioner of that art, Miss Ethel Merman. Eric Bloor, London-bound from Hollywood, offers comment on the American and British radio styles. Miss Lillian Satani, captain and catcher of New York's leading softball team, is interviewed concerning America's newest game for the masses. And John Sebastian performs notable feats on that definitely USA instrument, the harmonica. With three hearty cheers for the red, white, and blue, then we enter upon
the Rudy Valley Hour, Act One, presented by the makers of Royal Desserts, Royal Gelatin, and Royal Puddings.
In your book, you credit Rudy Valley with creating the variety show, which I guess was the most popular form of entertainment for the next 50 years in America.
Yep.
And how did that come about?
Rudy Valley is an amazing figure. I mean, in fact, researching Rudy Valley kind of led me to write the book because I felt that no one really knew about this guy. I mean, I thought of Rudy Valley, I thought of, you know, that sort of caricature of the 1920s, a guy with the megaphone and the raccoon coat cheerleading at a football game, which was his very suave. He was a very good-looking man with a beautiful voice. And then I discovered that he was a tremendous radio guy. And he began in local radio in New York, doing, you know, leading his band. And by just making himself, you know, introduce the songs and be kind of friendly and sing, people would come to the clubs he was playing in. Then in 1929, actually 4 days before the crash, he goes on the air, and on the NBC network Thursday nights at 8 o'clock, sponsored by Fleischmann's Yeast, and he is an instant hit. His show has tremendous audience, but basically what he's doing is he's doing an hour-long concert, and occasionally he'll have a guest who he'll, you know, talk to for a few moments. But basically, he's being introduced by Graham McNamee, and he plays some songs, and he sings some songs. He might have a singer join him occasionally, but that was the sum total of the show. 3 years later, in the fall of 1932, actually during the summer of 1932, he goes to his sponsor, which was J. Walter Thompson, which was the advertising agency for Fleischmann's Yeast, which was owned by Standard Brands. And he says to the guy, "Listen, this is getting dull. I want to create something new." And so on the night of October, I don't remember the exact date, middle of October of 1932, Rudy Vallee goes on the air. Instead of having Graham McNamee introduce him, he introduces himself and he says, "Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Rudy Vallee from New York, from the studios of NBC. Tonight we're going to bring you something completely new, something completely different in radio. Let's call it variety." And I've seen the script, and I always tell you it's amazing because he led his writing right up to the word variety, and he paused. And that was the moment when the American Variety Show was born. And for the next 7 years, he had a cavalcade of people on that show, many of whom ended up having their own shows. He introduced Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy to American radio audience.
A ventriloquist on the radio, that's kind of
fun. Which I still don't understand it, but he introduced them in 1936 to the American radio audience. He stayed on the air, Vallee did, on that Thursday night time slot with the same sponsor for 520 consecutive weeks.
Wow.
Which is incredible. And I've listened to many of his shows, and he was just a genius at putting it together. Just brilliant at putting it together.
I was going to ask you, how much of the early days of radio before 1932 exists that you could actually listen to?
Not a whole lot. I mean, there are some clips of Lindbergh in 27 and some clips of Amos and Andy shows. There are a few Amos and Andy shows that exist. But not a lot. It's hard to listen to most of that stuff, and it's real scratchy what there is.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get into the early 30s, 31, 32, it starts becoming much easier. I mean, a lot of FDR stuff was all preserved.
Yeah.
And the World Series stuff, the famous called shot of Babe Ruth is preserved in the fall of 32. In the Chicago series where he pointed out to right center field and then proceeded to hit the home run there. So, I mean, there's that stuff. But, yeah, no, there's not a lot from the earliest years.
So who else was on with Rudy Vallee that went on to their own shows? You mentioned Edgar Bergen.
Well, there's a wonderful story of a guy named Joe Penner.
Want to buy a duck.
You want to buy a duck. It's amazing. Some people know that line, and I'm glad you do. Want to buy a duck. Joe Penner built his entire vaudeville act on the line, "You want to buy a duck."
And he carried a duck around with him.
That's right. And it became a Marx Brothers toy, because the Louis Marx Toy Company, not Marx Brothers, Louis Marx Toy Company, created a Joe Penner duck, which was one of the best-selling toys in America. Penner was introduced by Vallee, and Penner ends up getting his own show with the Standard Brands as his sponsor. I think it was called the Baker's Breakfast or something like that, and he was on, and he was doing extremely well. But after a year of doing it, he gets bored. And he goes to the sponsor and says, "I want to change the show." And they say, "What, are you crazy? We're number one ranked show in your time slot. We're not changing anything." And so he quits, and he disappears. But they didn't want to cancel the show, so they turned it over to his band leader. Now, here's the amazing genealogy of radio for me. You go from Rudy Vallee to Joe Penner. Joe Penner quits. His band leader takes over. His band leader, it is known, is dating the lead singer. And eventually their marriage becomes part of the show. The band leader and his then-now wife, the lead singer, end up having a television series.
The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, starring young America's favorite couple, Ozzie Nelson and Harriet Hilliard. Let's look in at the Nelson home. It's 8 p.m. Dinner is over, and the head of the house is sitting in the living room. Ozzie is right there beside her.
So there's your genealogy of what happens from the Rudy Vallee Show, which is pretty amazing.
Well, it's a fascinating book. It's called Hello, Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio, and the author is Anthony Rudell. We've just skimmed the surface of this wonderful little book, and I think you should all go out and read it. Anthony Rudell, thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight.
My pleasure. I hope everybody enjoys the book. And if you want to hear some interesting old clips, my website has some on it, anthonyrudell.com. You can go to that and listen to some old radio on there, too.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. From the Bookshelf is available as a podcast from our podcast page, KUSP.org, or find us on iTunes. I'll be back again soon with another great program. As always, thanks go out to our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beale. Thanks, Breanne. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Gary Shapiro.